Good morning, everybody. Glad you could all make it here. My name is Ed M., and I am an alcoholic. And that's why I'm here today. And we're going to have a meeting that you're going to remember. I guarantee that. All right? And some of that's going to have a lot to do with you, so we want you to be awake and alert and involved in this here. We're going to have three speakers today and a half of a fourth. And I'm going to do a couple of readings to give us some focus on our topic today. And our topic is the great reality within. And when I came here, the great reality within was based on a lot of fear. And that changes as we stay in Alcoholics Anonymous and participate in our program of recovery. And probably my favorite page in the book is page 25. So I'm going to give a little focus to that by reading this part here. And it says that the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact in our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. And our first speaker today is Melanie Snowflake C., and she comes from South Dakota. Let's give her a real warm applause.
I'm Snowflake from Rapid City, South Dakota. My sobriety date is June 15th, 1988. And to begin this, I need you to understand my real name is Lonnie Sherman Cross. The snowflake, when my husband and I first met, I was questioning God's love. And my husband was driving around one winter day, and it was snowing. He said, "God, show me." God said, "What do you see?" He said, "I see snow." And God said, "That's made up of billions and billions of snowflakes. I put that much love and that much creation into a simple snowflake. How much more love and creation did I put into creating you?" So my husband gave me that nickname because among all the women, he considers me to be unique and one of God's kids. God brought me from South Dakota down to the International, which is a miracle. And I got this letter in the mail asking me to speak, and I was like, "You gotta be kidding me." But all I could do was say, "It's God. It's God in my life that brought me here to Texas." And I get to stay with my sister, my oldest sister, 30 miles away from here. The great reality within for me is the God that's in my life today. You know, I knew religion when I was little, but I didn't know that spirituality. I didn't know that no matter where I was in life, that God was going to be with me. I can be in a sea of people, and I can be at peace. Everybody asks me, "Are you scared?" And I just have a peace because God is with me. My sponsor is here, which is another one of God's miracles. I have friends in this audience. I want to say happy birthday to a gentleman that I don't even know, but he's celebrating 20 years today. Happy birthday, Vince. There's some things that I've been given, those little nuggets, those little tools. God fills the peace in my heart. I can't, He can, and I'm going to let Him. I need to draw on His love each and every day. I need to understand all the miracles that are in my life. I have the strength of a lion. My husband and I, in August, will be married 9 years. For our 10th anniversary, we get to go to Africa and celebrate our 10-year anniversary and get married in an African village. It's been a dream of my on my heart since I was a little girl because my grandmother donated to missions. And now in the church that I get to go to now, I get to do that. I get to fulfill miracles in sobriety. I just celebrated 22 years of sobriety. You know, those are miracles. You know, you take it one day at a time, but when you have 22 years and you get to come to an international, my husband had to sign on our brand new house while I was gone. I told him, if you've ever seen my signature, I have a smiley face behind my signature, and everybody says, do you sign that every time you sign your name? So I told my husband before I left, I said, when you sign my name, you got to put a smiley face behind it. He said, that's your thing, not mine. But those are just miracles. God gives us miracles. We walk outside and we see the rain. The rain is from Him. The sunshine. Looking around this room, that's the great reality within. The great reality within. We get to be sober today. We get to celebrate life. We get to go through all those challenges, the ups, the downs. I don't have to struggle. I don't have to medicate today. I can celebrate life. You know, my sponsor told me that I needed to read and find in the big book where that great reality was within. And when I left Rapid City and I got here, she said, okay, did you do your assignment? And I said, yes, I did do my assignment. Well, I have a sister-in-law that used to be my sponsor, and she fired me because I didn't work my program. But God has a sense of humor because now she's my sister-in-law. And before I left, one of my sisters, there's six in my family, and three of us are in sobriety, and my sister said, okay, when you're standing up at that podium, just pretend everybody's buck naked. And I said, oh, that's going to be really good. I'm going to stand up there and start laughing and pee my pants. I don't want to do that. But I just greatly appreciate all of you being here. And I thank God for sobriety. And that's all I got.
Thanks so much, Bonnie. Our next speaker comes from another part of the country, and she has a totally different experience that we get to hear. And I'm going to give you KT from New York City.
Good morning, everyone. My name is KT, and I am from the west side of Manhattan. And my sobriety date, my sobriety date is January the 9th, 1970. And it was all a day at a time. The reality for me when I got here was that everybody around me drank. That was the story of my life. My mother and father drank. When I was about four, I lived with an aunt and uncle of mine who were wonderful to me. But my uncle drank and gambled and lost everything. And I went to live with, came back to the United States to live with my parents who didn't have a home. We lived with some other people. And they also drank and lost everything. And when I was about 14, I went to live with my aunt in the Bronx. And in that household, I had five cousins. My youngest cousin was a periodic alcoholic who drank her whole life and was never able to get sober. But I didn't understand alcoholism, but I knew that there was something very powerful about alcohol, that it really seemed to do something to people. You know, the change of behavior, the fact that it was time to move on, that there was something about it that was very powerful. When I was about 16, I had some wine at Christmas time. And I can remember I got a terrible headache, but I didn't tell anyone because despite the fact that I didn't like the headache, I really liked the sense of being a little distant from my feelings and being a little distant from the world. And unfortunately, that need to have that feeling of being distant and away from everyone and eventually away from myself just increased over time. It was a slow, periodic progression. And I reached a point when I was in my early 20s and I was married that my life had become so narrow and so small that really everything sort of circulated around how I could get my booze. You know, on the surface, I really tried to do all the things that I thought were expected of me. I went to work and I cleaned my house and I washed and cooked and all of those things. But I was absolutely absent. I was married. I was absolutely absent in that marriage. And I reached a point where I realized when I got sober that I not only was separated from other people, I was really separated from myself. And I made a suicide attempt, and I got really scared about that because I thought, gee, that's going to make a lot of trouble for a lot of people. So I continued to try to function. And then I reached a point where alcohol did not work, really didn't work. It was the most despairing time of my life because I knew that I couldn't live without alcohol, but it didn't work, and I really didn't know what to do. I had been a practicing Catholic all my life, and I went to church. I thought of God as some deity who was really absent from me, although I didn't see God as punitive. I really had no sense of connection with God at all. And I remember I got to the last row in the church, and I was sitting on the aisle, and I knew that I was going to go out the door very shortly. And there was something really kind of frightening about that to me. But on that New Year's morning, when I realized that alcohol did not work, I had drank all night, and I could not get any surcease from the pain of living, I got down on my hands and knees, and I asked God for help. I used to ask God for a lot of things, but this time I asked for help. And the message that came back to me was to go to AA. And so there was an AA meeting in my church, which I attended that following week. And I will always remember that. It was a great big group in the Bronx. And the people seemed so convivial and happy, which I really didn't understand. I expected it to be very dour and somber. And there were several things that I remember from that. I met my sponsor at that first meeting. And she's here today. And I remember she said to me, can I take you to a meeting tomorrow? And I had thought I'd probably come back in a week or a month or sometime now. But I had a clear sense when I was there that these people seemed to know how to live. And I didn't know how to live. And I felt if I throw my lot in with this crowd, I think I'll be okay. And so, of course, I said, yes, I'll go to the meeting tomorrow. And I think that it was really mostly because I was pretty compliant that I didn't want to be antagonistic, that whatever suggestions were made to me, I followed them. And again, there was that sense, though, that these people seemed to know what they were doing. At that very first meeting, it was a three-speaker meeting, I saw the first part of the first step that said I was powerless over alcohol. For me, that was a great gift because I never thought of being powerless. I always thought that I somehow had to manage. I could drink other things or drink less or try to time the drinking or whatever. But it was clear to me that said, you're powerless over alcohol, and that meant I could not drink. I left that meeting with a sense of hope, which had been absent from my life for a long time. And you know that feeling when you, first day that you don't drink, it's so different. There's something kind of frightening about it. But as time goes on, you know, some of the realities of life begin to encroach upon you. And it became really difficult to think about not drinking. And I tried to use all kinds of little symbols about, you know, seeing alcohol as poison. But there was also the reality of that incredible kind of restlessness that I felt all the time, that anxiety and restlessness. And I remember it was my sponsor who encouraged me to go to step meetings. And I went to step meetings from the very beginning. It's my home group is a step group. And even though I certainly didn't understand the steps, and I think it's an ongoing process, I continue to see that these steps manifest some new meaning for me all the time. But I understood the words. You know, I could understand the words. And I saw that it said that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I knew that I was powerless about alcohol, but I also knew that somehow there had to be some sort of power to help me to deal with that. And it does tell us in the big book, in this the chapter about this reality, it asks us about, are we willing to look for a power? Are we willing to look for a power outside of ourselves? And for me, it was really learning to pray with an abandon that I had never had. You know, I would pray for specific things, but I began to just pray to God to be willing to not drink. That's what I would pray for. Please, God, help me to not drink. The early part of my sobriety was really a very rocky time. There were a lot of problems in my family. And my mother, whom I was incredibly resentful about, she was elderly and she had Alzheimer's and she was living with my sister. And because of circumstances that I won't go into, I was also living with my sister. I was commuting. I used to commute. And I remember going home on the train thinking to myself, how am I ever going to stay sober? I have this demanding job. I spend 3 hours a day commuting, trying to get to a meeting every day. And now I have to go home to my mother, whom I don't want to be with. And I remember feeling really sorry for myself about how I'm struggling so hard here, you know. Well, I heard a woman in the program, and I won't go into a lot of detail about it, but I heard her speak about the fact that her mother had been very negligent with her. And she said, you know, my issue isn't what kind of a mother I had. My issue is, what kind of a person am I? And I began to think, I said, gee, that's a different way to think. it was for me, I can tell you. But I began to think about that. I said, here's my sister with a husband and 3 little kids and my mother and now me sleeping on her couch, you know. Maybe I can think about doing something useful. And that came from praying. I used to pray all the time that I was going home on that commuter train about, please, God, help me with this. And, of course, what happened then, I think essentially really was like a 9th step. I began taking care of my mother, who lived for 2 years. And that was one of the most healing experiences of my life. And I know that it came directly from my asking God for help and for realizing that this was put in my path so that I could learn something, you know, learn something about myself and something about my attitudes. And that even though I was very newly sober and didn't really have much to offer to anyone, I was able to be useful. And that's, I think, a great message for all of us that, you know, we can be useful in one way or another. When I was sober about 2 years, I started going to a retreat. It was a Franciscan retreat house, an AA retreat. And I remember at that retreat coming home and feeling the presence of God. And I thought initially, this is really just sort of a high, you know, that I feel. But it wasn't. It was something that stayed with me. I used to drive a lot in my work at that time. And I would get into the car every morning and think about God sitting in the passenger seat with me. And that sense of feeling the presence of God in my life, I am very, very grateful to say, has stayed with me. And you know, in the course of living, and I would have to say that AA has given me my life, but among the things that I can say it's given me is an opportunity to really experience life. You know, when I got here, my life was so small and so marginal. And in the course of being sober and living, I think I've been able to experience so many things that I never experienced. I don't need to want to be distant from myself, distant from other people. I've been able to not feel that restlessness of my alcoholism. I've been able to find times of really feeling peaceful and tranquil. I was very fortunate that I married a man in the program, and the years that we had together were the most wonderful years of my life. And since he died, I've never been lonely. I was always lonely my whole life. And I think it's because I was really able to be transparent with someone else. I'd never been able to be transparent. And I knew that somebody loved me who knew me. You know, not as I would like to be, but who I really am. And was able to love me for who I really am. And, you know, that sort of sense of peacefulness and joy were things that I never could have experienced. I've also known times of terrible grief, and I've had some illness and I've had some pain. But you know, the thing that was interesting to me when I was ill and in pain, I had found a prayer in my husband's wallet when he died, and in essence, this prayer said, I do not know the road ahead of me, and I don't know where it will lead me or where it will end. But I know, God, that you will never leave me to face my perils alone. And I used to say that little prayer to myself, and I knew that I wasn't alone, that God was always present in my life. And so, you know, I've come to a place where I feel that God is always present with me, and that whatever life holds in store, and God knows what it holds in store, that I feel that, you know, whatever it is, that I'm ready to say yes to it, because God will always be there, and that I will always be guided if I can really seek that help. I would like to just read to you this little a bit from chapter 4, which is about the reality. It says, We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It is so with us. I would like to read to you from, I read some spiritual readings in the morning, and this is part of the reading from yesterday. And I thought, when I read it, I thought about coming here today. We've all heard the adage about stopping to smell the roses. It is easy to see God in the beauty of a radiant rose. But God is also in the thorns that prick the finger and in the dirt that nurtures the roots of the rose bush. If we open our hearts, we can see God everywhere we look. And God peeks out at us from hidden places we don't see. Every particle of matter is made of God's stuff that manifests continuously and completely through that particle. Just for a moment, imagine your search for the divine as a metaphysical version of the childish game of hide and seek. The only difference is, in this game, God says, ready or not, here I am.
Thanks so much, Kay. I told you we were going to have a good meeting here. And part of the reading that Kay just read, it starts out right before that, and it says, from We Agnostics, actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and a miraculous demonstration of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feelings that we had for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found that the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. And now we've got another special treat for you. I'll give you John H. from California.
My name is John Hoppen. I am an alcoholic. And for those of you that thought Johnny Harris was speaking today, you can leave now and we can get the disruption over and we'll be fine. I had a woman walk up to me before the meeting. She says, "Are you the Johnny H?" I'm just using the word she used. She said, "Are you the Johnny H from California?" I said, "No, but where are you from?" She said, "I'm from Australia and we have your CDs and we have me." I said, "No, I'm John Hoppen from San Jose. Are you going to leave now?" She said, "No, I think I'll stay." So if the woman from Australia is still here, I'm glad you're still here. There she is. Snowflake and Kay, great, great. The great reality deep within us is a powerful topic. It's very emotional for me, and if we begin to cry up here, cry with me, it's cool. I need the help. I want the support. Snowflake mentioned the letter that we got back, and, I checked the date. It was March. And so this talk has been going on since March, folks. If you're anything like me, I've been speaking in my head for the last 4 months, 5 months, whatever. So I don't know which one you're going to hear today. Hopefully it's the one that God said, "Okay, John, today. How about today?" I took some notes. I don't know if I'll be able to refer to them. I want to thank Ed for his readings. He stole everything I was going to read. I don't know. It's just, I'm having fun. Are you having fun? Yeah. That's a far cry from where we've been. That's a far cry from where we've been. And I was thinking of this topic again, and I was thinking about how it's a dual topic for me. I had to understand the great reality within me in order to receive the great reality within me. I had to understand that I was an alcoholic. I had to understand that I behaved in a way that was totally unacceptable to society. I remember towards the end of my drinking that I was sitting there going, I was thinking that someday I was going to stand at the pearly white gates of heaven. God was going to let me in. And the fact of the matter is that I was just doing a bunch of crap. My behavior was terrible. And I had to eventually accept that. I had to eventually accept what I was and what I was doing. And until I could do that, I couldn't accept that reality that I knew that was sitting there. I think every one of us in this room knows that reality. I think every one of us in this room has known it at one time or another, because that day that we all got sober, I don't know about you, but this was my day. My day was I went to that reality deep inside. I asked for God's help. The prayer of the alcoholic is, "God, help me." That's somewhere deep inside. That's somewhere inside. Bill talks about that in the writing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somewhere deep inside this fundamental understanding, this fundamental belief in a power greater than ourselves. Alcohol was a power greater than me. It definitely was a power greater than me. In 1964, 65, I was a scared little 13, 14-year-old kid, and my parents liked to drink, and I would take a Coke bottle. I took this Coke bottle, and I filled up everything out of the cabinet of my dad's booze cabinet and put it in that Coke bottle. And it was a little bit of gin, a little bit of vodka, a little bit of whiskey, a little bit of bourbon, a little bit of whatever else he had. I think there might have been a little vermouth in there. Or like W.C. Fields used to say the word vermouth over the top of it. That makes a martini. But I put all of that in that Coke bottle because I was going to an eighth grade dance and I was afraid. And I was scared and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. But I saw what alcohol did for them. And that day, that night, when I drank that bottle of Coke filled with booze, it did for me what I could not do for myself. There was a power greater than me. It turned me into somebody that I didn't think I could become. I was gregarious. I was outgoing. I danced. I don't remember a thing. But it did for me what I could not do for myself. And in the end, alcohol did to me things that I would never do to myself. My last drunk was in November of 1983. My sobriety date's November 11, 1983. I owe that directly to Alcoholics Anonymous. Directly to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that day, I was restless, I was irritable, and I was discontent. And I decided that at 10 o'clock at night that I'd just go to the local bar and take the edge off. And I don't know why I thought it would be any different, but everyone in this room knows that we tell ourselves it's going to be different. We tell that person inside of us it's going to be different this time. And I went I went out for a couple of beers. I thought I'd be back in a couple of hours. I left a 12-year-old girl asleep alone in the house that I was at. That was my girlfriend's daughter. And that girlfriend had left town to go on a business trip and said, "John, I can't take it anymore. If you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving and I'm taking Cheryl with me." And, you know, and so I had resolve. I was going to say, no, you're right, I'm not going to drink. Alcoholics have great resolve. We have great willpower. Until we don't have great willpower. And so I went out and I had a couple of drinks. And a couple of drinks turned into a 4-day run. And I abandoned that little girl and I left her in that house. And somewhere in the middle of that run, I called her up and I said, "Cheryl, how you doing?" And she said, "Well, I'm okay because the neighbors were taking care of me." And I said, "I'm really glad you are because I'm not." And when I got back home at the end of that run, that's when I said that prayer. On November 11, 1983, "God help me. God help me." Somewhere deep inside is a great reality within. Now, I didn't tap into that reality as much as a lot of people do when they first get sober, okay? What I got were two messages. One was is that, "John, you can't get drunk if you don't pick up the first drink." That shocked the heck out of me. Really? How in the heck can I do that? And then I got the second piece of that, which was, "You can do that a day at a time." That came from a vision that I got in that prayer of a movie called Come Back, Little Sheba. And there are probably a lot of heads nodding in the room that have seen that movie. And I got to see an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in that movie. And I got to see a guy get a 1-year cake and then a guy go out and a 12-step call. And that was all in the meeting. It was all in the movie. And that vision came to me in that moment of prayer. Moment of prayer. And that was enough to keep me sober for a number of years. I would stop in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I would go to my now home group. Then at the time it wasn't. My home group is Saturday Night Live in San Jose, California. We have over 33 meetings a week. And if you're ever in San Jose, stop on by. I think it's ironic that it's right in the same building where I used to shoulder tap to get alcohol when I was in high school. At least it's ironic to me. It may not be ironic to anybody else, but it's ironic to me. And so I began this journey of sobriety, of staying sober. I would stop into meetings every so often, and I would hear what I needed to hear, and I would leave. And I married that girlfriend, and we had a child in 1986. And in 1989, what happened is that unrecovered alcoholism started to show up. And unrecovered alcoholism, to me, looks like this. "John, it wasn't all that bad. It wasn't all that bad, John. You can drink again." That's a lie for an alcoholic. That is a lie. And I started to entertain that thought. And through a series of events and circumstances, which now I understand was a power greater than me, because in 1988, somewhere right around in there, I went to see an old friend of mine that I used to drink with. And he offered me something to drink, and I said no. That's all I did. I didn't talk to him about staying sober. I didn't talk to him about not drinking. We were having dinner together, and he offered me a beer, and I just said no thanks. And a couple of months later in 1989, around the same time, coincidence? Around the same time I'm having these thoughts, he calls me up. And he had 30 days sober, and he said, "John, I want to talk to you about AA." And I said, "Gary, I can't talk to you about AA. I really can't. But what's up?" And he says, "I got 30 days sober, and I'm afraid, and I'm scared." And I said, "I can talk to you about that. I can talk to you about not drinking. I can talk to you about being afraid. I can talk to you about being scared. I can talk to you about doing one day at a time." And we began to talk. We talked on the phone. He came to town, and we talked even more. And it was at that time, and I said, "When you come to San Jose, we'll go to a meeting together." And that's when I went to a meeting at Saturday Night Live, and we have a temporary sponsorship box in the back of our room. And I put my name in that box, and someone called me up. And ever since that phone call to this day, I have been in the middle of the herd of Alcoholics Anonymous, a step taken, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it makes a difference. In my opinion, it makes a difference. At least it made a difference in my life. So I had to get into the steps in 1989. I didn't drink. It was a miracle. I didn't drink. But I had to get into the steps because I had to understand the reality within. I had to understand who and what I am. And when I open a meeting and say, my name is John Hoppen, I am an alcoholic, the am is very important to me. It's very important to me. I now know who I am because you gave me tools to look inside. You know, you gave me tools to uncover the destruction and the life that I was leading in order for me to move on and to get rid of it. It's very interesting to me, if you ever thought about it, Bill thought that self-knowledge was the key. And he found out that it wasn't. But yet we spend a great deal of time trying to understand ourselves in Alcoholics Anonymous because it is the key. It is the key. The difference here is that when we are in self-propulsion and self-centeredness and seeking self-knowledge, we do not have a power greater than ourselves joining us. That, to me, is the great reality deep within. I'll never forget my third step. I'll never forget my third step. And I hope that you have something similar to tell. I really do. I went to a parking lot on Hamilton Avenue in San Jose, and I did a third step prayer with my then sponsor on my knees. And I had been in parking lots on my knees for a lot of different reasons than that. And if your mind just went somewhere, that was probably where I was. But I got to tell you that this particular night was different. It was different. Because I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I then understood God. And if you read in Bill's story, he talks about that. He talks about his white light experience. He talks about turning his will and his life over to the care of God in the hospital as he then understood him at that time. That time. This is an ever-evolving thing for this alcoholic. And so when I did that third step prayer, I fell into his arms. I fell over into his arms and he caught me and he held me up. And he said something as powerful as the energy in this room right now and as powerful as this entire convention is, as powerful as the God within each and every one of us is. He said, "Welcome to the fellowship of the Spirit. Welcome to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous." This is an incredible place to be. How do people like us become people like us? How does a man like me become a man like me? If not through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is a great reality within each and every one of us. There is a solution. There is an effective solution. When Ed read that, the word effective just jumps off the page at me. I have been transformed and changed. Transformed and changed into a human being. Into a loving, kind, gentle human being. I have had the opportunity to grow in sobriety, to heights I never thought I would ever reach. And I'm just going to share a couple of stories. Do I have time?
We got a lot of time.
Got a lot of time? You're going to give me a lot of time? We could be up here for a while. A great reality within us. I had to find out who I was through that process of uncovering and discovering. And then I found out how God fit into all of that by discarding. God came into my life by getting rid of all of the junk that was inside. And I got to understand who my true self was. And I began to realize that I am a human being with a great deal of love and kindness. And in 19... Whiskey and LSD were two of my favorite friends, and I don't have a lot of brain cells left. But some time ago... Okay, I got it now. It came in. When my son, my now 24-year-old son, was just starting Little League Baseball. He was about 7 years old. And I found out that I had an affinity for umpire in Little League Baseball. And I liked to umpire. And I became a Little League umpire. And I was a guy with a little balloon around his chest. And I was like, he didn't know what the heck I was doing back then. But I know that I had a passion for it, and I started to umpire Little League Baseball. And I decided to get better at it. So I went to the Little League school down in San Bernardino, California, and I started umpiring higher-level tournaments. And then I decided, you know, I want to take this to the next level. So I went to the Professional Academy of Umpiring in 2006, and I went to their five-week program. And I graduated from their five-week program at the Professional Umpiring Academy. Now, I'm too old to be a professional umpire. But what that afforded me to do was to start umpiring college baseball. And how does a man like me become a man like that? Can't happen without the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Can't happen without a connection to a power greater than myself. And I remember that, you know, in 2007, my career got better and better, and here I was in 2007. I got a letter to go umpire at the Western Region Tournament in San Bernardino, Little League Baseball. Now, I got to tell you that when I was 8 years old, I got cut from a Little League team. And I never played baseball again. I played softball, but I never played baseball again. I think God has a great sense of humor. And I found myself on that field every day, right before the game. We'd stand there with all of our partners in this field. And this is Little League Baseball with 7,000-8,000 fans in the stands, folks. And they would do the Star Spangled Banner, the national anthem. I'd look up at that flag and I would say a prayer and I would thank God for the opportunity to be on that ball field. It was an incredible experience. Little League Baseball does a thing called it's like Special Olympics. They do challenger games for kids of special needs. And every one of us, there were 14 of us umpires, that went out on that field and umpired with about 30 kids playing baseball all at the same time. It was awesome. They were in wheelchairs. They were rolling around the field. They were running in different directions. They didn't know where the ball was. How does a man like me get to do things like that? Can't happen without the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Can't happen. There is a great reality within me, and it is the knowledge that God does for me what I cannot do for myself, just what alcohol did for me. But I prefer this side of it, believe me. And I'm going to finish with one more story. A couple of years ago, I got involved in doing H&I work. And I encourage you, if you have any inkling at all, to pass this word on. There are people inside that need it. They need it. They want it. They're hungry for it. And I started going to Soledad State Prison in California. And just 2 weeks ago, I was in a meeting with a bunch of lifers. And we were sharing on the sixth step. And I heard some shares in there that would just knock your socks off, knock my socks off. And I walked up to this young man who could barely speak English, and he was a young man. And I started to talk to him. I thanked him for his share because it was profound. And he said, well, do you know where I could get an extra grapevine? And I said, why? He said, because I wrote to the grapevine, La Viña. I went to La Viña, and they said they're going to publish my story, and they wrote me a letter back, but I haven't been able to get the magazine. I said, oh, man, okay. Now, we have La Viñas and grapevines, thank God, they realized they could take the staples out and glue them all together, and now we have them in the prisons. Yes, absolutely. So I said, no, but I'll find out where I might be able to get you a copy of that magazine. Well, he thought it was the May-June issue. He got his dates mixed up. Gee, alcoholic who gets his dates mixed up. I can identify. So I took that story, and I just walked out of the prison and went home. And, you know, it's like I said, a couple of weeks ago. Well, my first experience here in Seattle was walking up to La Viña, the booth, right here in the registration hall. And I met a woman there by the name of Irene, and I started to tell her the story. And she started to shake. She's the woman that wrote him the letter. And I was able to meet the woman that wrote him the letter. How does this happen? This doesn't happen to people like us without a power greater than us. Thank you for letting me share.
Thanks, John. This is the part when I got the letter and was actually asked to do this, and they said, we're asking you to chair this meeting, Ed. I said, well, you know, I like to speak. They said, well, you're supposed to. He said, you're supposed to comment on this. I said, really? He said, well, yeah, if you have time, you know. So I'm going to comment a little bit on the topic. Not because I'm egotistical and self-centered, but because of that and other things. I'm Ed M., and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 11th, 1986, and for that I'm grateful. And since we are in Texas, that's the way they start their meetings. I want to tell you that I come from Group 356, which is in District 52, which is in Area 38, which is Eastern Missouri. And for that I'm very grateful, too. And I really want to thank our speakers tonight, this afternoon. They were wonderful. So many things they said had hit home with me. And one of them that was that John mentioned the grapevine. You know, the grapevine is the Journal of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a living, breathing part of Alcoholics Anonymous, written by alcoholics for alcoholics. And I believe there's a tremendous disconnect in our fellowship that we don't use the grapevine in 12-step work. And I think it's so vital and so available for us to use. And it's going to be changing and changing and changing again, not just the new grapevine with the perfect binding that he mentioned that we get in prisons, but we're going to see a new digital reality for the grapevine. And this isn't a grapevine meeting, but there is some meetings on this at the convention this weekend, so avail yourself to those. And I hope that you and your groups are subscribing to the grapevine. Wherever I speak, I always mention the grapevine. I'm a former General Service Conference chair of the grapevine, and it's near and dear to my heart. But that isn't part of the great reality within for me. The great reality within for me when I got here was that I was riddled with self-centered fear and didn't know it. I was a daredevil. I was a risk taker. I was bold and afraid of so many things I didn't even know until I got a little distance from it that that's what it was. I had a hole in me so big that I couldn't fill up with a churning inside like a percolator. And alcohol was my solution. And I never heard that in the treatment centers that I went through. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, if you're an alcoholic, then alcohol is probably the solution to your problems. And that's what made me listen. That's what made me come back. That and the fact I had nowhere else to go and I was court committed to a state hospital, but it helps the story along, though, if you tell. I listened because alcohol was what made it right. Alcohol took away the symptoms of alcoholism. Like Ace said, it quit working. I was still addicted to it. I didn't know what to do. And for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I, like you, probably felt that I was different, that my case was different. And I probably was different, but I was just as alcoholic as anybody else and everybody else. And I drank just as alcoholically as you did and just did the same, you know, disgusting, embarrassing things as you did. And it takes us what it takes us. It takes us as much time as it takes us. And so the great reality within for me was that you people were different, just like me. And you people believed in something. My sponsor said, do you believe this stuff? I said, no, no. Do you believe that I believe? And he had that little glint in his eye, and I said, yeah, I think you believe, you know. And we had about as much in common as, you know, I mean, I had an art commune in the 70s and 80s in the Ozarks and did film work. And he was in a blackout and still wore Brill Cream and Vitalis in his hair, you know. And so with John on the LSD and a lot of those other mind-altering substances, you know. You know, my life has changed and changed and changed again. I want to tell you about a couple of those changes, and I'll let you out of here. And one of those changes was that I began to listen. I listened to what people said, and I listened with my eyes, and I watched what you did and how you did it. Not so much what you shared in meetings, but how you really conducted your lives. I've got people I sponsor in the room, people they sponsor. Friends from different countries and states, and so many things that have been part of this fellowship that's grown up around me, like our book talks about. And so many times what I've done to help myself was to get out of my own way by carrying the message to another alcoholic. When I can do that, my problems are lessened. They're solved. They're relieved. They go away. Things that I can't deal with. And I think that's how I see God doing for me what I can't do for myself. When I got here, I had a very difficult time loving people. I was not a lovable person. I could not accept love. I didn't know what to do with it. And it was through the process of the steps, working with a sponsor and the nurturing of my home group, that I began to understand what the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous meant and what that meant by people reaching out and becoming one in unity. You know, I learned by the example of people who came ahead of me. My friend Sis is here. She spoke in St. Louis in 1955 representing young people in AA. You know, she's been... That's enough, Sis. Listen. See? What are you going to do? Anyway. But, thanks, Sis. What happened was, through the period of time, and through the steps, and through working with others, and through the traditions, I learned to live within my own skin, and to practice a reality that was much, much closer to God's will for who I was supposed to be, I think. And I was one of those people that had a spiritual awakening after the 12th step, but still was not able to function very well in my own skin. I actually could have handled things better when I was drinking. Business situations, personal situations, interpersonal situations. You know, it was somewhere around a two-joint, four-beer reality or something like that. You know, where you look at their outsides and you think, that's about how I should be if they were there, you know. And it took a lot of time, but eventually Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that same thing that those substances did, but without the buzz. And what happened was, by dealing with other people and reaching out to other people and carrying this message of hope, I began to change. And I began to get into the whole process of AA, because it's not so much that I just want to know how this works. To me, this is a wholesale miracle. This is a living miracle. It's a time of miracles. You can see all of you from all over the world here. You know, how did that all happen? And, you know, we look at the program and we have these three legacies and this legacy of service. And some people say, well, if our founders were here today, they wouldn't recognize who we are and what we've become. And, you know, you can tell those are people who don't read the literature. And because we have a... We have this, it's called the Secret Service Manual up here. Okay, you know? And we hide these answers in these books. People don't know that in AA. So one's called Language of the Heart. You should see the radical stuff they wrote in there. You won't believe it. You know, and so I started looking at some of these things. And, you know, if we are the evolution of this process, if we are who we are to become, if we are in this state of becoming, then, you know, we go from the steps, the traditions, through the concepts, through our service entity, and we look to the future. So who is AA, and what is AA, and what are we to be, and what did the co-founders think, you know? Well, if you look at Article 12, Concept 12, the conference charter, where it's our Bill of Rights, and, you know, and Bill wrote that, and it's... can't be changed, you know, without 75% of written permission from all groups within 6 months. You know, that's going to happen. And yeah. How many of you couldn't decide which meeting to go to at 11:30 today? You know, that emotional sobriety meeting looked pretty good, I'm telling you. But... When Bill closes this whole thing, you know, and he draws it all together, and I'm not going to go through the articles and the warranties in Concept 12, but I do want to say, because it's had a tremendous impact in my life by example, because it's what I see in Kay. It's what I see in Shirley. I see people who keep coming back because they can. because we let them. And so what Bill says was, he of course goes through this whole thing about all the warranties where we'll be democratic in thought and action, and we're more than an egalitarian organization, and we have all these other things going. But he closes it up and he says that the sum of all these attitudes and practices is, in our view, the very essence of democracy in action and in spirit, the living Alcoholics Anonymous. Freedom under God to grow in his image will ever be the quest of Alcoholics Anonymous. May our General Service Conference be always seen as the chief symbol of this cherished liberty. To a person, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that our freedom to serve others is truly the freedom by which we live, the freedom in which we have our being. That tells me that if I want to be free and become who God wants me to be, that I need to serve others. And it is through serving others that I find myself. And it is when I find myself that I find the reality within, which is the higher power, the God of my understanding. I love you all, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. Thank you.